The second scripture reading is from the Hebrew Bible, and it's from a wisdom book, Proverbs. Listen, children, to a father's instruction, and be attentive that you may gain insight. For I give you good precepts. Do not forsake my teaching. When I was a son with my father, tender, and my mother's favorite, he taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words, keep my commandments and live. Get wisdom, get insight. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, and she will keep you. Love her, and she will guard you. The beginning of wisdom is this, get wisdom. And whatever else you get insight. Prize her highly, and she will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place on your head a fair garland. She will bestow on you a beautiful crown. I wanted to say to you, Dorothy, and to you, where's Margie? Margie? Okay. All right, she left. Where did she go? All right. I know it's cool. Should we all go down there? It's cooler down there. All right. We're going to stay here for now. But Margie and Dorothy, that was a beautiful hymn and song, violin solo. It was beautiful. And that Spirit of God descend upon my heart. This was the piece that was shared in 1978 on November 15th, just prior to my vows of ordination. So that's the hymn I chose. It was in the little church, Lake Odessa farming community, and all the bigwigs were there. I mean, they were bigwigs, too. You ought to see them. They have big wigs. All right, let's see. What does that come from? Why big wigs? What does big wig mean, anyway? So, thank you, Laura, for the sharing of the... it's called different things, by the way. It's the prodigal son. We know it as the prodigal son. But it's... if you look at our New Revised Standard Bibles, you'll see it's called The Prodigal and His Brother. In sharing this parable, Jesus appears to suggest that those who are in leadership positions in the Jewish community would identify with the elder brother. He's the one, after all, he remained devoted to his father, his homeland, as well as to ancient laws and traditions. Likewise, many of us could identify with that older brother harboring ill feelings towards those who are self-centered and greedy and misuse this precious life in one way or another. What complicates matters, however, is more than a father welcoming home a wayward son. This father serves up a magnificent banquet for the abusive and selfish younger son, and then, adding insult to injury, presents him with the best robe and ring and sandals. And all of this takes place without the knowledge of the elder son, who has remained at home. He remained devoted to his father. He managed the homestead. So there's the parable in a nutshell. That's a summary of it. So much of what we have been taught about right and wrong, good and evil, crime and punishment, all goes out the window in this parable. The ancient prophets, they cried out for justice and kindness and humility. However, the younger brother has lived unjustly, unkindly, lacking in all humility. It is why we, as good church-going folks who live by the book, who obey the laws of the land, may take the side of those Jewish leaders who were angry at Jesus for sympathizing with this reckless, conniving, manipulative, selfish, younger son. If we, like the father in the parable, reward this bad behavior with banquets and robes and rings, won't this just encourage the younger son, as well as those prodigals in our society who commit crimes and misdemeanors, to continue this intolerable behavior? Lessons must be taught, bad deeds must be punished, or chaos and lawlessness will ensue. The parable comes to us as one of three in a row after the Pharisees and scribes have scolded Jesus for eating with sinners. Jesus doesn't argue with them. He tells them three parables. One about a shepherd who left 99 sheep all alone while he went to search for one lost sheep. Two, about a woman who turned her house upside down in order to find one tiny lost coin. And three, about a father whose love for his two sons was unconditional. All three of these parables are conveyed through a single point of view. Rather than dwelling on others and their behavior, the focus is on a shepherd, a woman, and a father. And they are completely consumed in the joy of finding a lost sheep, finding a lost coin, finding a lost son. Jesus does not begin this parable saying, "There once was a prodigal son and his brother." Instead, the parable begins, "There was a man who had two sons." Knowing all about our church and how inclusive we are, let's take gender out of it. The prodigal son could also be a prodigal daughter. And besides, I can do this on Father's Day because I'm a father and a parent. So, there. Here's a parable about a parent with two children, a parent who loved two children more than anything else in the world. The parable is driven not by the behavior of either child, but by the behavior of the parent. In fact, we could call this the parable of the prodigal parent. I like things that begin with P. The word prodigal, think about it. It has two definitions. One, like the younger child who is wasteful and excessive, and also like the parent who is extravagant and generous. See, there are two definitions going on here. What about a parent's tough love? What about confession? What about penance? Acknowledgement of wrongdoing? In a way, words like "I'm sorry" become sacramental as a way of cleansing us of past mistakes so that we can move into the future. But according to the parable of the prodigal parent, no confession is necessary, no act of contrition is needed, no promise of better behavior in the future, no forgiveness of those who have committed great wrong. The loving parent who sees us coming home for the first, second, and umpteenth time will continue to rush out to embrace and kiss and forgive us over and over again before we can offer any word of apology. So, according to this parable, love does mean never having to say, "I'm sorry." Maybe this is true in a poorly written novel, but in terms of our life together, this sort of ditty, it's intolerable. Love does mean having to say, "I'm sorry." Doesn't it just irritate you when you know somebody who just can't say it ever? Who can't ever say, "I'm sorry"? I screwed up. I messed up. I made a mistake. Love does mean having to say, I'm sorry. This is true for the prodigal behavior of the younger child, the self-righteous behavior of the older child, and even the prodigal behavior of the parent. We all need to hear words of forgiveness, because forgiveness is a part of the foundation of the Christian religion, isn't it? After making mistakes of any sort or committing evil deeds without any form of punishment, won't we just go out there and do it all over again? I have plenty of therapeutic books in my library which explain that all of us are in need of forgiveness from the shame that binds us. And when we get it from God or from one another, we know what renewal and reconciliation in the future are all about. In order to be forgiven, someone has to have fallen short of the glory of God, which may be as simple as having failed to be kind to somebody else, but which may also be as tragic as having accidentally killed someone, say in an automobile accident. Whatever the dirty deed might be, very few of us would deny the possibility of forgiveness, but most of us would insist on an apology, a confession. And in our law-abiding society, the willingness to pay for the wrong that has been done. And yet here is a parable about instant forgiveness and no strings are attached. Paul Tillich says, the unconditional love of God both fulfills and violates our sense of what we have known to be true and right. Indeed, Jesus told a very dark story about a totally narcissistic, irresponsible, self-centered younger child whose desire to get away from the family meant asking the parent to settle the estate early and give both children their share. So think about it. Going to your parent and asking for your share of the inheritance right now while the parent is still alive. Now, Monty Python has a saying there. Monty Python says, but I'm not dead yet. Now that's vulgar. And further, what sane parent would concede to any child who obviously would waste his or her portion of the inheritance? This is not a normal parent. And the older child recognizes this odd behavior. Maybe this parent needs to be institutionalized. As the story goes, this parent divided the estate anyway and said goodbye to the younger child, who went off and, of course, squandered everything. While working on a pig farm, this younger child decided to return home, composing a pretty calculated confession, one designed to get back home with food and shelter, possibly living now as a servant rather than as a family member, but better off than on a pig farm. This was not an act of contrition, but more of the same manipulative behavior previously experienced. To further complicate things, this rascal younger child has returned to live off the inheritance of the older sibling. Because remember, the parent relinquished the inheritance to both children. So now the parent doesn't have the inheritance anymore. What's left is all the older child's inheritance. And yet this parent, ignoring property ownership, immediately takes control by throwing a party and unconditionally welcoming home this good-for-nothing child, showering this prodigal with the elder child's fatted calf and robe and ring and sandals. And why? As the parent explains to the elder child, this younger child was dead and is alive again. Your sibling has been lost, but now is found. I am the eldest child in my family, and I know what it is like to break parents in, to step aside as they exercise their new and their improved skills on younger siblings. In my case, a sister, Nancy, and a brother, Bob. I take the rap over and over again for the messes that they make, the mistakes that occur, because I'm the first. I'm the oldest. That's what oldest kids do. Older kids frequently get the raw end of the deal. Let's not forget that the elder child in the parable was not as angry by his younger child's return as much as by the celebration, by the gifts. So let this rascal return, but let this prodigal come back to penance and not a party. Why throw a party for this person who's disobeyed all of the rules? Why reward bad behavior? What in the world is the moral instruction in this kind of welcome? What about facing the consequences of irresponsible actions or reaping what we sow? What kind of world would this be if we all made a practice of rewarding sinners while the God-fearing folks work from dawn to dusk? I mean, what do we have to do to get a little attention around here? The church thrives. Our church thrives. All churches thrive on its ministries to the poor and to the broken, to the sick, the outcast. But what about those of us who are holding our own, who are doing the right thing? What about those of us who are getting up early and working all night, burning our candles at both ends, trying to take care of our families, nurturing our relationships? We take care of our health. We work hard at our jobs. We pay our dues, but we never get any credit. While we're quietly holding our own, the homeless, the addicted, the prodigals out there seem to get all of the attention. It's not fair. What do we have to do to get a party around here? Do we have to grab our inheritance and then go off and waste all of it because we can come home to be embraced and kissed, to have a big party, to be rewarded with plaques and gifts, certificates of commendation, assured that we do belong? Listen, the elder child protests, "For all of these years, I have been working like a slave for you, and I've never disobeyed your command, yet you have never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this child of yours came back, who has devoured the family property with prostitutes, what did you do but kill the fatted calf?" The elder child says, "This younger child of yours," which says, "No relation to me." Likewise, the elder child wants the parent's love, because here is a child who has stayed put, followed orders, and always done the right thing. And yet the parent does love the elder child, but not for any of the right things accomplished. The parent does not love the younger child or the older child according to what they deserve. This parent loves them because who the parent is instead of who the children are. Here is a love that transcends our understanding of right and wrong. It is a love we share with one another when we gather every Sunday morning in this expression that I read from the pulpit. No matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you are welcome here. A prodigal parent answers the elder child, "You are always with me, and all that is mine is yours." We had to celebrate. We had to rejoice because the sibling of yours, not my child, but your sibling, was dead and has come to life, was lost, and now is found. The parent's invitation is extended to the older child to enter the relationship not only with the loving parent, but also with the wayward sibling. It's a running theme in our church. It needs to be. Penny Phelps was in the pulpit last Sunday. She spoke of it when she said that the opposite of hate, the opposite of fear, what is it? It's connectedness. It's relationship. It's dialogue. It's being one with another, with each other. It's listening to what the other is saying. And Sarah Kineff, she spoke of it two Sundays ago when she elaborated on the journey she has taken in order to be a foster parent. And what was the title of her beautiful sermon? We need to take care of each other. And we, those elder children who have been given so much, whether or not we recognize it, maybe have more of a responsibility to care for the earth and for one another. The parable ends with a to be continued. The story suddenly stops with the elder child standing outside the home with the parent. And both are listening to the party. It's going on inside. Jesus leaves it that way. And I think it is left that way because it is up to each one of us to finish the story. It is up to each one of us to decide whether we will stand outside all alone in our self-righteousness or give up what we think is fair and even and deserving and go inside to take our place at the family table full of reckless and righteous saints and sinners, brothers and sisters, all the children of the world, united only by our relationship to a parent who loves us without conditions. A parent who, as William Sloane Coffin says, refuses to give us the love we deserve, but cannot be prevented from giving us the love we need. Amen.